Thank you. I guess the only thing I'm sure of that will be some of the fallout from the Thomas hearings and confirmation process is that Anita Hill will be offered a professorship at Stanford University Law School. When the paperback edition of Revolution was published, almost 3 years had passed since I had finished the original manuscript, and I decided I'd try to add an introductory essay to the book. That essay I called The Reagan Legacy. And the purpose of it was to try to explain some of the strange, and I thought false, accountings of the political events of the 1980s. To try to explain why, I think in a profound sense, the battlefield of ideas had shifted from politics and politicians to professors and pundits. And to try to make the case that the intellectual colleagues of all those left-wingers who were defeated on the political battlefield are now mounting a powerful counterattack by rewriting history with little regard for objectivity and truth. An attempt which, if it succeeds, will allow them to retake by poison pen the political prizes they lost by secret ballot. And tonight I'm going to take most of my remarks from that essay. Not too long ago, the New York Times carried a remarkable statement on its front pages. A fellow named Filipov, a member of the city council of Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, in the former Soviet Union, who said, quote, "I agree with those who say we must hurry quickly away from Marxist-Leninism through socialism to Reaganism." Unquote. You know, could this Soviet politician really have meant to say what he said? I think the answer is yes. As we enter the 1990s, the philosophy of Marxism and the modern practice of communism has been smashed throughout the world. And rising to take its place is something that I think can best be described as the idea of Reaganism, or the current practice of capitalism in the United States. Today, the prospects for world peace are greater than at any time in our lives. The threat of nuclear annihilation has faded. Both the former Soviet Union and the United States are destroying significant portions of their nuclear missile arsenals. Troops are coming home all over the world. The United States is more prosperous than ever before. The economic model and envy of every nation on earth. During the 1980s, we had the greatest economic expansion in our history, producing a $6 trillion economy, more than three times the size of our nearest competitor. Personal liberty is spreading to more and more people as communist dictatorships topple like hollow dead oak trees in a high wind. The state of socialist tide has been turned, and liberty is on a triumphant roll. And these are remarkable times, times of peace, times of prosperity, times of liberty. The ideals that civilized men and women have pursued for centuries, ideals now more within reach than at any time in the history of man. And these transcendental victories did not come by accident. They were the concrete results of the efforts of tens of thousands of men and women who fought the tyranny of the socialist state and won. And many of those men and women are in this room tonight. They were the intellectuals who fought with ideas, fighters who fought with bullets. They were the politicians who led the way. No one person could have done it alone. In fact, all were necessary for it to have happened. But tonight I want to argue that there was one person who contributed a bit more than any other, one person who became the political leader for the forces of peace and liberty in the world, and that was Ronald Reagan. And his legacy is the crackle of events we watch with wonder. The Berlin Wall coming down, the Soviet Union crumbling, the destruction of nuclear weapons, the events that are rapidly transforming this world into a safer place, a more prosperous place, a freer place. As I said, he did not create that intellectual political revolution that swept the world in the 1980s, but he was its political leader, its driving force. He led the United States back to greatness in the power of its military defenses, the strength of its economy, the freedom of its people. and by so doing, established our society as a towering model of a good society. And in a world dark with cruel oppression, poverty, and crushed human spirits, the United States has risen even brighter as a brilliant, powerful beacon of justice and peace and prosperity. But now, while the pivotal role of Reagan seems to be recognized by foreign leaders in strange lands like our friend Filipov and St. Petersburg, it seems much less appreciated at home. As Reagan becomes a legend around the world, his own role in the ongoing worldwide revolution is virtually unsung in his own land. Here, we read and watch the momentous events exploding everywhere. One rarely gets a sense there's any connection between what is happening now and what happened before. There is this eerie feeling of suspension in time, as if somehow, some way, by some great cosmic stroke of luck, world peace broke out, the threat of nuclear war faded, and prosperity bloomed. There is even a bizarre school of thought developing that argues that, to the extent the policies of the Reagan administration did have anything to do with the revolutionary events of the 1980s, Reagan himself had almost nothing to do with those policies. That he was an amiable bumbler, not too bright, no clear vision of what he wanted to do, and no plan to carry it out, even if he did know what he wanted to do. When the Revolution was published back in 1988, I thought it dealt with many of the critical questions of how Reagan rose to power and how he governed and what some of the results were. But then when serious questions rose about Reagan's leadership abilities, I decided that I would try to resolve some of those things, and I made a special trip down to Los Angeles for an interview with him. And I wanted to ask him some questions, whose answers I thought might be important to anyone trying to understand how he accomplished what he did. Questions about his personal plans for the presidency, his strategy for achieving them. For example, while he was president, did he have any special strategies for dealing with the mega issues of national security and economic policy? Did he really believe the Soviet Union was an evil empire? Who was the driving force behind Star Wars? What did he say to Mikhail Gorbachev when they met privately at the 1985 summit in Geneva? Now, the Reagan that I knew, the one that I had campaigned with, and I see me sitting over here, reminds me of some things we did, back in 1976, 1980, was a man with a clear ideological vision that I shared, a man with a tough-minded view of the world, a man with a talent for devising unusual strategies to get what he wanted, and a streak of rugged independence that was masked by the warmth of his personality. That was the fellow I had written a book about, not the genial dunce who had little or nothing to do with major policy decisions about who I've been reading so much recently. For the last 4 or 5 years, a torrent of books and articles on his presidency had painted a portrait of a dumb but likable man, a man who either deliberately abdicated his responsibility, or worse, simply didn't know what was going on most of the time. Now, at first, this characterization of Reagan struck me as preposterous. I mean, were serious people actually suggesting that someone that slow-witted and irresponsible could manage to get elected to California, governor of California? I know some of you are thinking of Jerry Brown, but that's... But let me finish here. That slow-witted and irresponsible could manage to get elected to governor of California, governed successfully for 4 years under the critical eye of the California press corps, get reelected, serve successfully for 4 more years, come within an eyelash arresting the Republican nomination from a sitting president in 1976, win that nomination in 1980, get elected president of the United States by beating an incumbent president, serve successfully for 4 years under the intense scrutiny of the press corps, and then get reelected in 1984 by one of the largest margins in United States political history. Now, if Ronald Reagan did all that and was only half as dumb or removed from the decision-making process as his critics claimed, then he had to be the luckiest man ever to walk this good earth. But no one's that lucky. I think the record of the Reagan presidency, people want to look at it, is very clear and sharp. Economic mess Reagan inherited was cleaned up. We have enjoyed not the longest, but the greatest economic expansion in the United States history. Almost 8 straight years of economic growth, marginal personal income tax rates lowered dramatically, inflation down, interest rates down, almost 20 million brand new jobs created, stock market boomed, almost tripled. In fact, this week a remarkable event occurred that went largely unmentioned in the press. You know what that was? Dow Jones hit an all-time historical high, 3,061.72. I don't know what happened today. It probably went, did it go way down today? It went up? New record today. I can't keep up with this. The Cold War with the Soviet Union ended. The first nuclear arms reduction treaty in history was signed. And peace and capitalism began to break out all over the world. Americans once again felt proud to be Americans. Beyond that, as the socialist-communist idea began to crumble in country after country, Reagan's 8 years demonstrated clearly, beyond any doubt, that the political economic system of capitalism was vital and powerful and morally superior to any other we've ever known. It was Reagan's America that became the role model for the world at the precise time that, as prime antagonist and chief competitor for the loyalties of millions everywhere, communism was collapsing. Not because it had been tried properly, but because it had been tried so well. The charges in recent writings that Reagan was a bumbler and not involved in the big decisions of his presidency seem to stick, though. Books and articles drumming on this theme continue to roll out. And the authors are not cranks or hacks. They include some of the country's top newspaper and television reporters, and most damaging, some of the former president's highest ranking, closest aides. Let me just briefly review some of them. I think one of the most serious indictments for Reagan was an 89 book wickedly entitled The Acting President by Bob Schieffer and Gary Paul Gates. Schieffer, chief Washington correspondent for CBS News, a man who speaks to and is trusted by tens of millions of Americans who watch him on television every week. Here's what he said, quote, Ronald Reagan had very little to do with his administration and the issues that came before it, period. And there was a book called Landslide, subtitle, The Unmaking of the President, written by two correspondents for the Washington bureaus of the Wall Street Journal and the Los Angeles Times. Bill in the Jacket copy is the first authoritative account of President Reagan's second term. The book charged, quote, Reagan's rule bordered far more than anyone wanted to admit on a no-hands presidency. Reagan was both amiable and friendless, ill-informed and incurious, trusting and careless, stubborn and passive. He was neither an adept administrator nor a master of the mundane intricacies of policy, unquote. But the first book to really paint the lie that Reagan was dumb and indecisive was David Stockman's book, 1986, The Triumph of Politics. Stockman concluded, quote, Reagan had accepted but never grasped the political consequences of the revolution I had brought to him on the eve of his election. And now he had no idea of the fiscal failure I was leaving behind, unquote. Now, we can ignore Stockman's megalomaniac claim that he conceived the revolution, but we cannot ignore Stockman's charge that President Reagan did not understand his own economic program. That charge damaged Reagan's reputation throughout the world as well as at home. And though false, it was a sensational charge that fed the prejudices of many people, and it became part of the big lie about Reagan's competence that has begun to spread and take hold. That's a water here. But I think the most telling attack on Reagan was Donald Regan's book, For the Record. Now, for 7 years, Donald Reagan had served Ronald Reagan, faithfully, like your worshipful, if somewhat arrogant, dog. First as Secretary of the Treasury, and then as Chief of Staff in the White House. Then in early 1987, after the Iran-Contra fiasco, President Reagan fired him. Donald Reagan was angry, indignant, and soon exacted his revenge with a poison pen, slashing away at the one sensitive, vulnerable point he knew President Reagan had, Nancy Reagan. The first line of Don Reagan's book, not many people remember this, but it was a new low in non-chivalry, quote, this is how he began the book. Nancy Reagan stammers slightly when she is upset and her voice was unsteady. Book went downhill from there. Reagan saved his most malicious attack for the man he believed had publicly humiliated him. Quote, this is Don Reagan speaking. The president himself had very little to do with the invention and the implementation of the policies and mechanisms that encouraged this remarkable increase in the nation's wealth and general well-being. There was no design for leadership. There was no inventory of national priorities, no philosophical consensus on which policy was based, no system for carrying a problem that subordinates could not solve to the president for final decision. Policy seemed to be made on the basis of a belief in public opinion that amounted to superstition, unquote. No leadership, no priorities, no philosophy, no final decisions. One can only wonder what government Mr. Reagan is talking about. But the book sold briskly, buoyed along by the snickering tales of backroom astrology, and the whopping lies about Reagan's presidency went right along with them. Then, without doubt, I think the most brazen book on the Reagan presidency was written by a young man in his early 30s named Mark Herxgad. I can never pronounce it. Herxgad? Published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux in the fall of 88, called On Bended Knee, The Press in the Reagan Presidency. Now, this took the big lie about Reagan's intelligence and his involvement with major decisions a leap forward. He argued that the National Press Corps had treated Reagan's affliction of stupidity much too gently and kindly. And in his view, the American press portrayed Reagan as far more competent than he was. And Herxgad went so far as to entitle one chapter, The Amiable Dunce. It is perhaps no surprise to discover that Herxgad, billed on the jacket of his book by his publisher as an investigative journalist, unquote, is a former fellow of the Hard Left Institute for Policy Studies and dedicated his book to I.F. Stone, a famous American Marxist. But the disingenuous complaint of the book is clear. If the national press had done its job properly on behalf of the left, Ronald Reagan would not have succeeded as well as he did. There are other books. There was Sleepwalking Through History, America in the Reagan Years by Haynes Johnson, whose theme you can figure out from the title without bothering to buy the book. There was Kitty Kelly's book on Nancy Reagan, which wandered off in a fantasy land at the end by asserting confidently that it was Nancy, not Ronald, who governed our country for 8 years. And perhaps the title for the most outlandish book is a recent one that just came out called The Illusion of a Conservative Reagan Revolution by a political science professor named Larry Schwab, which serenely declares that nothing really happened. Incidentally, that means especially in the Supreme Court. Well, the most serious of the false charges is this one that Ronald Reagan was not involved in the important decisions of his presidency. And I knew from personal experience with him in the campaigns in the early years in the White House that that charge was completely untrue in the area of economic policy. He made every one of the big decisions on tax rate reduction, spending control, economic deregulation, and monetary policy. But what about an even more important area? What about national defense, Star Wars, Soviet Union, arms control? I was curious, so when I went down and did that interview with him, I asked him about this. And he answered flatly, I came in with a plan. And let me just go through several of the key points that he made during that interview. First of all, he was keenly aware that a nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union would have devastating consequences to both nations. But he was also convinced that the Soviet leaders did not think that way, that they flirted with the idea of fighting a nuclear war, that they would win. And one of Reagan's goals was to change the Soviets' mind, to convince them that winning a nuclear war with the United States was impossible. Reagan was also deeply committed to the idea of reducing the nuclear missile stockpiles of both the United States and the Soviet Union. And maybe one day, he hoped, getting rid of all of them. Now, the reduction of nuclear missile stockpiles, and I hate to say this as a former staffer, was Reagan's own radical idea, conceived by him during the presidential campaign. Dismissed by everyone as hopelessly unrealistic, it was a special dream that he nurtured through the years. And as president, he made the dream a reality. Now, how did he do it? How did he bend the Soviet leaders to his will? He didn't plead. He didn't appease. He didn't shout and bang conference tabletops and issue orders to aides. He didn't ask for a lot of advice. He didn't even set up committees. Instead, he set forth on his own, carefully placing the building blocks of his personal strategy. First of all, he had no illusions about the nature of the Soviet government in the early 1980s. He threw the Soviet leaders off balance and placed them on the defensive when he denounced the Soviet Union publicly, remember now, as an evil empire, in a speech on March 8, 1983. Now, most people don't recall that was just 2 weeks before he announced that the United States planned to build a protective missile system known as Star Wars. Speaking in Orlando, Florida, I would argue that what he said in the speech was much worse than an evil empire. Let me just read you some of it. He was brutally frank. He said, quote, about the Soviet Union now, "While they preach the supremacy of the state, declare its omnipotence over individual man, and predict its eventual domination of all peoples on the earth, they are the focus of evil in the modern world." And he then depicted the conflict between the Soviet Union and the United States as an apocalyptic, quote, "struggle between right and wrong and good and evil." And then he urged his listeners not to ignore, quote, "the aggressive impulses of an evil empire," unquote. Now, Reagan's critics were appalled at the stunning breach of international protocol. I mean, my God, actually saying that an evil empire was evil. Some hopefully dismissed his words as a temporary slip. Maybe a couple of words penned by a mischievous right-wing speechwriter like our friend Dana Rohrabacher, who was there at the time. Not so. I asked him about this, and he said, quote, "When I call them the evil empire in a public speech, I did it on purpose." And he said it without a trace of apology or regret in his voice. He went on, quote, "I wanted them to know that we saw them for what they were," unquote. That's why he said it. This public attack on the soft underbelly of the Soviet political system, its moral moorings, gave Reagan a major psychological advantage in his duel with the Soviet leaders. Now, they and almost everyone else complained and sputtered and fumed about the evil empire charge, but the charge was true and the impact was telling. Then Reagan began to move behind the scenes. For four years, in fact, he had studied the possibility of building an effective missile defense system for the United States. In fact, well, Ed Meese used to chair the meetings we had in the White House in the early years. And his search for a way to defend against enemy nuclear missiles grew from his strong distaste from our longstanding nuclear policy of mutually assured destruction, which he always referred to as, by its an acronym, MAD. He said, quote, "You know, I thought that was the most ridiculous thing I had ever seen. It's like two guys with guns pointed at each other's heads and cocked and thinking that neither one of them will take a chance and pull the trigger. But to have the power to destroy, literally, the civilized world, and it would only take a somebody pushing a button. If they launched theirs first, you know that ours would be on their way, even though we'd be blown up too," unquote. He thought long and hard about that dilemma. And then I asked him how Star Wars got going. Remember, that was announced in March of 1983. And he said, well, quote, I call a meeting. This is now December 1982. I call a meeting of the chiefs of staff in the cabinet room, and I said, look, every weapon that's ever been created in the world has resulted in a defense, a defensive weapon, the sword and later the shield. Isn't it, with our technology, possible that we could produce a system that could hit those missiles as they came out of their silos, using space, whatever? And then he said, they kind of huddled for a minute. Then they came back and they said, could you give us a couple of days on that? And I said, yes. And a couple of days they came back. And they said, yes, we think it is worthwhile. We think with today's technology, we can develop something of that kind that would virtually make them obsolete. No one would want to press the button if you knew that only half a dozen of the weapons would ever get through, leaving us then able to retaliate, unquote. And then I remember Reagan kind of folded his arms and leaned back a little bit, and as he remembered the order he gave that winter day that set Star Wars in motion, quote, so I said, all right, we start. Go to it. And so we started that plan, unquote. Then more than 3 months passed before the world and most of the president's closest aides knew what he had done. So in addition to fundamentally altering our nuclear defense policy by beginning Star Wars, Reagan had, from the first day of his administration, relentlessly pursued the goal of increasing our defense budget. And he had been spectacularly successful. When he entered the White House, we were spending $134 billion a year in national defense. When he left 8 years later, we were spending $290 billion a year. So, when Reagan and Gorbachev sat down in their first summit meeting in Geneva, Switzerland in November 1985, Reagan came to the table with two trump cards in his hand. The first was a swiftly rocketing missile defense program. The second was a massive U.S. arms buildup. And this is how he played his national security cards with Gorbachev. First, he made it very plain that he would never give up an American missile defense system. Quote, said Reagan to Gorbachev, this is not a bargaining chip. Look, if we're successful, my own view is we should share it with you and with the world. I don't believe you, answered the incredulous Gorbachev. But Reagan pressed on, explaining the reasoning behind his extraordinary, unprecedented offer to share our missile defense technology. He said, quote, all of us know how to make these missiles now. That was before Saddam Hussein, too. So if we just say we're going to eliminate them and eliminate them, we would still have to live with the thought that someday along could come a man like Hitler and make them again and blackmail the world, unquote. Using the analogy of the old chemical warfare ban, Reagan drove home his point. Quote, he said to Gorbachev, back in 1995, we all met in Switzerland and decided against chemical warfare. We all agreed to do away with them, but we all kept our gas masks, unquote. And then Reagan played his second and most powerful card, America's productive might, making it clear to Gorbachev that an arms race with the United States was one the Soviets would lose. And I don't know whether you want to call it a threat or maybe just a statement of fact, but this is what he said. Quote, turned to Gorbachev and said, I will tell you now, we can continue to disarm or we can continue the arms race. And I'll tell you now, you can't win the arms race. There is no way. And just to make sure I had heard Reagan correctly, I stopped and I said, you know, you told him that directly? He said, yes, sir. I said, there's no way that we're going to allow you to maintain supremacy or anyone else over the United States of America. I made it plain to him also that in the destroying of nuclear weapons, this was going to have to be tied to conventional forces. Because they had superiority, and the only thing we had to respond to that superiority was nuclear. We aren't going to sit there and join them in nuclear disarmament at the expense of leaving them with a 10-to-1 advantage in tanks and artillery. And then Reagan paused, and his thoughts seemed to drift back to those private talks with Gorbachev, and he said, you know, he is the first Russian leader since the revolution who ever agreed to a treaty in which they would destroy weapons they already have. Always before, they would make treaties about how many they would come to but never were they willing to destroy a weapon. Now you hear them offering to destroy them all. End quote. You know, for many years, there was only one racer in the arms race, and that was the Soviet Union. And it must have sent shivers down old Gorbachev's spine when he realized that Reagan was not kidding, that he was fully prepared to unleash America's industrial might. And it must have been especially threatening to Gorbachev, because I'm sure he knew then, in late 1985, that the Soviet Union was in terrible shape. A fact only dimly perceived in the West, although somehow, and I don't know how he did it, sensed by President Reagan. 6 years later, today, even Soviet experts acknowledge their economy is in shambles. But it was in 1985 that Reagan sensed the Soviet Union's Achilles heel and he struck at it. Now, was this the president who was reportedly so disengaged from the major decisions of his presidency? When the historic INF Treaty was signed in late 1987 and bilateral nuclear disarmament began, few realized that one man, Ronald Reagan, had been its prime mover for over 11 lonely years, planning and plotting and driving toward the goal of a world unthreatened by intercontinental ballistic nuclear missiles. Can this be the man who was said to have nothing to do with the major issues of his presidency? Nothing to do with the greatest economic expansion the United States has ever had. Nothing to do with the collapse of the communist idea throughout the world. One final point. The same kind of lies now being told about the Reagan presidency were once told about the Eisenhower presidency. The last two-term president before Reagan, Eisenhower was widely regarded as an ineffective president, an indecisive man who was a bumbler, in spite of 8 years of unprecedented peace and prosperity. That false view of Eisenhower reigned for over 20 years. And it was not until the early 1980s that historians, the press, and other intellectuals reluctantly revised and then reversed their views. And the fellow who was most responsible for presenting a historically accurate understanding of the Eisenhower presidency was Professor Fred Greenstein, chairman of the Department of Politics at Princeton University. He wrote a book in 1982 called The Hidden Hand Presidency. And what is so extraordinary about it is that he begins with this admission, which I think is extraordinary for an intellectual. Quote, I had voted Democratic as a 1952 undergraduate majoring in political science and as a 1956 graduate student learning to teach and practice it. Before the decade was over, I had my students, my own students, and was teaching them to view Eisenhower in the same fashion that most of my colleagues and all the journalists I respected viewed him, as a good-natured bumbler who lacked the leadership qualities to be an effective president. Events, speculations, and hard evidence changed my view, unquote. Now, how could this happen? How could a nation like ours, with its incredible freedom of means of communication, with its thousands and thousands of historians and political scientists, miss such an obvious point for 20 years? Professor Greenstein points the finger at the major culprits when he says, quote, most writers on the presidency viewed him, Eisenhower, through the lens of his 1950s liberal critics, as an aging hero who reigned more than he ruled and lacked the energy, motivation, and political know-how to have a significant impact on events. That statement, I will argue, would apply with equal force now to how most writers today view the presidency of Ronald Reagan. And it is just as wrong today for President Reagan as it was wrong for 20 years for President Eisenhower. And this lie about Eisenhower did not arise in the political world. The mists of deceit wafted down from the intellectual world, the world of the professors and the writers and the journalists, where players' personal political passions are rarely identified clearly and openly. For decades now, most political scientists and most historians and most reporters have been left liberal Democrats. It's the way they vote. It's the way they think. And in effect, what they have done is to carry on the political battle that their comrades, the professional political activists, had lost. Now, the left may have lost the presidency to Eisenhower in 1952 for 8 years, But they won the history of that administration for the next 20. That is precisely what is going on now with respect to the writing and the history of the Reagan presidency. Today, most historians, most political scientists, most editors of our major publishing houses, most newspaper and most television reporters are living, breathing Democrats with deeply held political views. Many of them today are depressed and angry. And what we see in their writings is often a dishonest attempt to create the world they want rather than an accurate historical record of the world we have. I'm going to stop there.